Hello, I'm really glad to be here in this audience. As Simon said, I'm Angeliki Chrysanthi. I'm a PhD researcher from the University of Southampton and member of the Sahara Archaeological Computing Group. I'm also working as a research assistant on the Tapina project, which is funded by the digital economy and is run by a multidisciplinary team by five universities who work towards developing mobile and tablet systems to enhance research practices. Today I'm going to talk about an important part of my PhD research, which investigates movement and spatial behavior patterns of visitors in archaeological sites as a way of informing interpretive planning and strategies for presenting archaeological sites. A critical point of this study was the development of a hybrid methodology for collecting and assessing data on movement around archaeological sites and of the things that visitors value the most during their visit. For the development of my methodology, I worked with case studies from my non-archaeological sites, mainly from Eastern Crete in Greece. In the first part of my talk, I'm going to talk a little bit about my the background, the theories and ideas that influenced my research, and the research questions I set out to investigate. Then I'm going to give you a little account of my proposed methodology, which attempts to address some of these issues you're going to hear in a bit, and present some preliminary results. Planning for the interpretation and presentation of archaeological sites is a multi-layered and multidisciplinary process, and due to the unique characteristics and requirements, each site is dealt with separately. The term interpretation, according to the NA Charter, refers to the full range of potential activities intended to heighten public awareness and enhance understanding of and engagement with heritage sites. Presentation refers to the carefully planned communication of interpretive content through the arrangement of interpretive information, physical access, and interpretive infrastructure at heritage sites. The interpretation and presentation of cultural heritage sites entail a series of steps from ongoing research, publications, assessments, and interventions. The interventions range from physical enhancements of the site itself, such as restoration and conservation works, designating paths, designing contemporary structures, and interpretation centers, to graphical representations, and the employment of a range of media for its presentation to the public. One of the modes for intervening to cultural heritage sites is planning for on-site accessibility and circulation for visitors. Designing and implementing archaeological works constitutes a critical part of broader visitor and site management strategies, complementing the preventive conservation and enhancement of archaeological sites. In other words, this intervention aims to protect the site and enhance its values and visitor experience. In combination with other interpretive methodologies, it constitutes the main vehicle through which an archaeological site and its remains are presented to the public. The introduction of specific paths or walkways provides an essential interpretive tool, particularly in the case of sites with relatively poor architectural remains, such as some of my case studies, where limited interventions for the enhancement of their readability can be applied. It could be argued that catering for movement and accessibility in archaeological sites constitutes the cornerstone upon which the rest of the interpretive media are built. In essence, this process involves the physical as much as the conceptual and the digital aspects of such an undertaking, a notion that appears to be inconspicuous in the relevant literature and mainly in the actual implementation. The tendency for dealing with heritage in a fragmentary manner, dividing it implicatively for the understanding process tangible and intangible properties, has been identified as yet another dualistic approach to the discourse and addressed at the Comos Charter on cultural roots. The lack of a satisfactory also framework with regards to formal methodologies and design approaches of how movement around archaeological sites is dealt with is also evident in the existing literature. There are some general principles set by a series of international conventions, for example, the ECOMOS and the UNESCO and European Commission reports, some publications related to site-specific visitor management and interpretive planning, but apart from these, this intervention is planned as a site-specific task and according to the individual agendas of the interpretation specialist in each case. The starting point of this research were relatively recent theoretical approaches in heritage studies, which have pointed out the importance of the visitor's perception and the use of the experiential approach for the interpretation of archaeological sites. Much of this research is drawing upon phenomenological theory and the affective response experiential discourse of the visitor, and denotes that people's on-site experiences are vital to the interpretation process. As David Russell notes, if emotional and behavioral considerations are essential to attitude formation and change, then any information that excludes these dimensions is less likely to be effective. Additionally, interpretive planning and cultural heritage should accommodate the things we value from our past, and those things derived from our personal interests are diverse and complex way of perceiving and inquiring the remains of the past. It should not be a one-off and one-way process where interpretation is provided by experts for the visitors to consume. The visitor perception approach raises some questions about the authority of curatorship and the authority of the stakeholders over cultural heritage, which is something I address in my research and challenge through my methodology. So it is important for cultural heritage interpreters to acknowledge that people enter these sites with certain cultural and cognitive baggage, as well as certain expectations as to what they are about to see or learn. All the above, along with the information that the site provides, form the visitor experience. However, this aspect of the visitor approach is commonly disregarded by interpreters and practitioners of cultural heritage sites as elusive or non-scientific in interpretive planning. The question raised at this point is, how can we actually measure experience and movement behavior in such spaces and effectively use the results to inform interpretation? Is it theoretically justifiable and empirically practical to operationalize experiences by reducing them to quantifiable constructs? On the other hand, theoretical and experiential approaches, as compelling as they may be in their attempt to explore detailed individual accounts, are not enough. Convincing other researchers and policymakers of the relevance of your data and findings in an evidence-based world will require more than presenting a few evocative and moving narration. Another approach suggests that design should be informed by formal and quantifiable observation methodologies with the use of a variety of technologies for indoor and outdoor environments. For example, CCTV has been used, GPS, motion capture. Clearly, different stances on this issue have led researchers to different approaches in evaluating the visitor's experience. In other disciplines, such as human-computer interaction, where human experience is under scrutiny and user-centered design approaches start to prevail, this question has led to a concomitant methodological shift towards qualitative approaches from quantitative ones, but nevertheless, mixed method research integrating both approaches are often recommended for triangulating empirical findings. Another concept which plays a crucial role in my research is the role of affordances in human movement. When we are planning for cultural heritage interpretation, either in a contemporary space or a heritage site, we should take into account the certain spatial and interpretive character that each space already affords. Likewise, we should also assess the affordances we create with the various interventions. According to the psychologist James Gibson, pedestrian locomotion is thought to be largely dependent on the perception and the use of affordances offered by the environment for navigation. Gibson's theory of affordances has been interestingly explored in architectural design studies, providing an ideal ground for attempting to expand this theory into heritage site management. But I will have the chance to speak a little bit about this later. Finally, it has also been argued that the belief constitutes a critical factor which influences visitor spatial behavior, and there has been a lot of work also in interface modeling and space index which attempts to address the demand for quantifiable data. Summarizing a sentence, my research direction and questions is, I'm very intrigued by the visitor-centered approach of designing archaeological works, accessibility and interpretation in archaeological sites, and I'm also very interested in developing a hybrid methodology with the use of traditional methods and computing applications that will provide substantial and complementary information to interpreters about the hotspots and the affordances of the site for movement. Now, moving on to case studies and the development of my methodology. In my first data collection phase, I employed a variety of qualitative methodologies used traditionally, such as observations, interviews, and questionnaires. This process revealed some of the issues that these sites face in terms of visitor management and the areas which attracted notable hubs of activity. Apart from observations, I often try to engage the visitors in informal conversations. I see at this point that it is truly remarkable what you can learn from visitors about the site through their own lens of interpretation and personalized experiences. This process really enhanced my perception of what interests people in this site, a perception based on my own biases as a heritage professional. Also, I searched at web image repositories like Flickr and Panoramio to gather comments that visitors of this site posted. As we mentioned here, some general observations and attempt to link them to the theory. In the case of archaeological sites that haven't had interpretive interventions, images of visitors incoherently crossing the site and stepping on low-preserved ancient walls in their attempt to find their way around the site are frequently witnessed. This phenomenon occurs when the site lacks official special on-site interpretation, and thus the special organization and formal function of the monument is ignored by the visitor. Evidently, the perception of the archaeological site plays a crucial role in the interpretation of the site's structure and consequently in the movement process. One could argue that this behavior occurs despite the awareness, at whichever degree, shared by the Western cultured visitors that unorganized sites walking on ancient walls is not allowed and is discarded either by signets or duty guards. Indeed, looking at cultural heritage tourism surveys, as well as the demographics from my own sample, this description fits the profile of such visitors. Nevertheless, this argument can be quite misleading, particularly when it assumes that different visitor behavioral patterns are framed under a common Western-wide cultural umbrella and expressed as such in uniformity. This has provided a valuable insight on the human perception and movement, suggesting that it is highly dependent on locomotion affordances existing in the environment which is being explored. In exploratory locomotion occurring in public spaces or rural settings, such as the archaeological site, movement is conducted in the modern days of discovery, as opposed to habitual motion, where people are hardly aware of the surrounding built environment. Gibson defines a surface that fulfills four properties, namely rigidity, levelness, flatness, and extendedness, as walk-on-able, and argues that if there is optical reception of these four properties, then the affordance is perceivable. Extending this notion, he gives the example of a surface that obtains these properties and additionally is raised at the level of person's knees, making the point that this surface also affords sitting on. Paralleling this example to the case of rubble, low-preserved walls, it is becoming apparent that people, despite their cultural and cognitive baggage, perceive such features as surfaces to step on and sit on. Hence, if something attracts their attention, whose location requires that they walk over a wall, to get there, they will. The awareness of walking around the site under supervision of a guard, of course, might change these behaviors and choices of movement. On the other hand, in some of these archaeological sites, such as Knossos, there have been attempts to control visitor movement by constructing specific paths. Such attempts are considered to be successful in achieving the dual goal of protecting the site and providing the visitor with a safe tour. However, most of these visitor paths are incompatible with the architecture of the monument and constrain movement around the site, usually at the basis of time-scheduled group tours. In this context, the visitor is handled as a passive receiver of the informative site and rarely has a chance to interact with it and thus relate to it. Notions placed high in the agenda of the interpreters. Knossos is perhaps the only prehistoric archaeological site in Greece where reconstruction work has been undertaken on such a large scale. Sir Arthur Evans restored some components of the complex in order to protect the most vulnerable parts of it and applied his ideas on minority civilization. His extensive reconstructions on the actual archaeological remains set off a constantly increasing public interest for Minoan civilization, a fact which today places Knossos in top cultural visiting attractions of the world. Despite these misleading reconstructions, and although these kind of severe interventions are illegitimate today, the didactic results are widely appreciated. For others, these reconstructions, however, challenge the authenticity of the site. At Knossos, the visitors are not actually getting lost in the labyrinth as they might have expected. The visitor management plan identified and designated movement in three zones: the visitor welcoming and facilities area, the main site, and the green area around the main site. Also, a long, narrow path connects the usually noisy and crowded entrance to the main site, and as the architects envisaged it, it gives the visitor the opportunity to make the transition to the visiting experience at the main site. Also, three different base routes are designated, of which the central passes through the exposed antiquity and is assigned with a high-paced walking mode. Secondary routes are designed in the intermediate area around the main site, providing the visitors with the alternative to exit the main route from several points while pacing down their walk and viewing the monument from a distance. Finally, in the third route, movement is conducted freely in an area where people can enjoy monument surroundings, nature, and a comforting pine tree saddle. The conceptual schema of the zoning starts with strict accessibility regulations and fast-paced movement, pace movement around the main monument, and gradually, via the second route, becomes almost unrestricted in the third. Despite the conceptual intentions of the planners, the third route, which provides a paced, less restricted walk and areas where visitors can stop and view at the palace from a distance, oddly lacks of any interpretive medium. In result, the visitors just sit around, or at best they try to catch up with a reading from guidebooks, completely disconnected from the monument itself. Concerning intra-site accessibility, popular archaeological sites presenting large numbers of visitors are usually imposed with more accessibility restrictions. At the example of Knossos, the use of the grand staircase was not included in the visitor route, as mechanical and material erosion was identified as a result of use by visitors for decades. A middle ground approach between free accessibility and restricted presents the example of the archaeological site in ancient Messini in Greece, and although it's not one of my case studies, it's worth mentioning here. In Messini, the contrast of color and texture in applied materials on ground indicate the areas that visitors can walk and bring out the shapes of the building in two dimensions. So even in areas where preservation state is low and the visitor still can get a sense of the configuration of buildings and move accordingly. Also, the orientation of the monument, the main axis and ancient entrances are often ignored during the planning process of the visiting tours. To give an example, in this case of Zagros, the modern entrance to the archaeological site is different from the original entrance to the Minoan palace for practical reasons, and this has a certain impact on the spatial perception of the monument. The small parking lot and the ticket house are situated on the southeast of the site, so the visitors enter the site from the lower level, where the court of the palace is, and then often follow the ancient path to the ancient entrance only to realize that they found themselves in a dead end. It could be argued that archaeological sites today are rather obscure spaces. Architectural remains, contemporary structures, and the effects of time and nature influence these complex places. It has also been noted that archaeological sites today are perceived as not places, and as a consequence, the visitor cannot relate them to a familiar environment, either rural or urban. On a different note, scholars have resembled the typological layout of Minoan towns with contemporary Cretan villages. This observation automatically provides one with a powerful interpretive tool based on the recollection of prehistoric memories and embodied experiences. Indeed, this observation came up several times during the conversations I had with the visitors at Vounia. But in other cases, when it comes to understanding and processing the visual impact of the site while walking, not many references of such can be made. The caption of this image, posted in the web, demonstrates the visitor's perception of the palace of Zagros as a rubble field. Consequently, when we are dealing with movement and perception, particularly in Minoan sites, we should take into account the remains structural complexity and palimpsestic ruins, special human movements related to special stimuli, and human behavior towards the ruins or the aesthetics of the site. And now having established the complexity involved in this aspect of archaeological heritage management, I will move to the next step of data collection with the questionnaires. At the end of their visit, I asked visitors to fill in a questionnaire which was designed specifically for the purposes of my study. The questionnaire structure was influenced by the Space Saver, a tool developed by CAVE, the Commission for Architecture and Built Environment, which works as a participatory platform for assessing and redesigning existing public spaces with the necessary adjustments based on established related surveys in the field of archaeological site management. Apart from structured questions, including the demographics, the questionnaires were designed to allow people to express their opinion on what they value the most during their visit or dislike the most about the archaeological site. In total, 100 visitors took part in this first stage and provided their assessment and views on four basic domains: the on-site accessibility, the special perception and awareness of the site layout as they walk around, and the ease or difficulty in identifying the remains; the aesthetics of the site, for example, they had the opportunity to assess the preservation state, the conservation and maintenance of the site, and the contemporary structures and plantation. Also, they assessed the existing interpretive infrastructure and commented on what more they would like to see in future interpretive agendas. It is worth mentioning some of the responses from the three questions that visitors had a chance to respond freely. In the question, could you mention three things that you liked the most in this archaeological site? Many answered that they liked the fact that they could identify the houses of the settlement, the layout and their features, such as the separate rooms, the doorsteps and the stairs. They said that they could almost imagine how it might have been. They liked the ancient paved streets, the views offered within the site and the surroundings, and generally they appreciated the fact that the site was not commercialized and offered good accessibility all around it. Visitors that have visited already Knossos mentioned the juxtaposition between the two sites, and already, although they had read and knew more about Knossos, they actually enjoyed more their visit in Gounia. Finally, they really liked the fact that there was an ongoing excavation, but they would like to have more information about it. In the question, could you mention three things that you liked the least about the archaeological site? By far, many answered that although the information boards were well designed, there were very few. The lack of general plans and pictures of finds, as well as the lack of relevant books for selling at a ticket house, were also mentioned. Finally, in the question what the site is missing in terms of interpretation, they replied that they would like to see more graphical representations, information at each house with scenes from everyday life, as well as one that represents the whole site as the archaeologist thinks it might have been like. Also, I was able to retrieve responses from the structured as multiple choice questions, and in this slide you can see an example of the sort of data you can get. But apart from this stage of data collection, most of them that were qualitative, I decided to focus on one of the sites to develop a more sophisticated methodology on how people walk around the site and what interests them. For this, I chose to work with the archaeological site of Gounia, and before I proceed with presenting the methodology, I would like to say a few words to get you acquainted with the site. Gounia lies on a small hill, a few hundred meters from the sea of the Gulf of Mirabello in eastern Crete, an area particularly rich in Minoan archaeology, as you see from the distribution map of the Minoan sites. Gounia is the most characteristic of the excavated medium-sized settlement dated to the period of the peak of Minoan culture. It is called the Pompeii of Minoan Crete because of the good state of preservation. In 1900s, Harriet Boyd House excavated the center of this Minoan town, revealing a system of cobbled streets, 47 houses, a central building with a court, considered by some to be a small palace, and a cemetery. The ruins of the settlement were visible before the excavation, hence the name Gounia, given by the villagers, because of the stone bedding preserved in the area. The most important monuments of the site are the town on the slopes of the low hill, two peripheral paved streets, cross at right angles with others which climb the slopes of the hill and are often stepped. They are all connected to a drainage system and divided the town into insula, seven of which have already been excavated. The so-called palace, seat of the local ruler, is built on top of a hill to the west of the rectangular court, on which open many of the private houses. The interior of the palace is not well preserved. The site is open to the public, and of all sites of Aegean, Gounia gives the visitor the clearest idea of what a town in late Bronze Greece looked like. There is also an ongoing excavation led by Buffalo University, and conservation works on the northern part of the site. The reason I chose Gounia for testing my methodology is that apart from its well-preserved ancient path system and structure, it presents a case with minimal interventions and a subtle interpretive infrastructure, mainly limited to well-designed information boards. Also, the unfortunate event of Greece's cuts in the cultural heritage sector has influenced the available hired staff at the site. In fact, there is only one person working permanently at the ticket house. But this lack of staff actually gave me the opportunity to study visitors' unrestricted movement around the site. Apart from the observations and the collection of these qualitative data about visitor perception, tracking and recording technologies such as GPS, body tracking and camera recordings were employed. Each visitor was asked to carry a small lightweight GPS device, and usually visitors hang it, as you see from the picture, around their neck or put it in place in their pocket. And additionally, visitors were given a synchronized small camera and were instructed to take pictures during their visit as they would normally do with their own camera. This data collection method was proved unobtrusive to the visiting experience. And often visitors reported that they were not always conscious of taking part in an experiment or that they were assigned a specific task. In total, 36 GPS tracks and 644 images were collected. In terms of the GPS data quality, the open rural site, the good weather conditions and the lack of high vegetation provided an optimum accuracy reading of 3 meters all around the site. Additionally, the track value, which was set to record every 2 seconds, resulted in the collection of high-resolution GPS data. Now, in terms of processing the obtained data, a line-density analysis of the visitors' itineraries was carried out in ArcGIS. The interpretation of the processed data provided a better insight and an overview of the site affordances for movement, as well as the areas with increased accessibility. The areas indicated with red color are the areas that visitors walk on the most, and with blue the areas that were less visited. Also, some areas of the site, those which appear with no color, seem to have been inaccessible to the visitors. Under Gibson's theory prism, a series of affordances for movement in archaeological sites can be identified and explained. It is important to note that he refers to both physical and artificial properties of the environment as affordances. Leaving aside the properties of the landscape itself, within an archaeological site, some of the preserved features of its architectural character can afford movement, such as ancient paved paths, well-maintained structural features such as walls, fences, and other symbolic stone features, such as the sacred stone in the case of Gounia. The fact that Gounia has one of the best preserved prehistoric path systems and that the full preservation state of the palace allow visitors to walk over the ancient remain is directly reflecting on the visualized movement patterns. As you can see, here is the area of the palace, and here is its court. I'm going to mention this now later. Other areas leave open, flexible options as to where the visitors can move that could be either part of the ancient planning, such as the court of the palace over here, and others that reflect the disorganized area of the archaeological site, such as the palace that has really low-preserved walls. Also, movement decisions are initiated from a moment of stillness. People decide to stop and observe particular structures closer and continue their interpretive exploration. Therefore, it could be argued that the environment affords stillness as well. Further analysis of the captured logs can also indicate these areas. Additionally, the interpretation of combined data from existing interpretive infrastructure can provide an effective assessment. Interpretive panels play an important role in the way people move around archaeological sites, functioning as points of interest. The analysis of the data provide information about whether visitors passed by interpretation boards without reading the information, if they did, how much time they spent reading them, and whether the position of existing interpretive boards is the optimum for visitors and the presentation of the site. An example of this provides the area around House AC, where the density analysis indicated high accessibility of visitors despite it being off the main path. The house's entrance is well preserved, accessed by the ancient path system, and leads to a stone paved court. The information panel is placed inside the court, probably somewhere around here, and it's facing toward the entrance. The density analysis results not only indicated an increased access, as you can see at this point over here, but an attempt of some of the subjects to continue their walk through undesignated paths, possibly through a small corridor between the houses and over the remains. You can see this is the corridor, but over here more houses are laid out, so when visitors try to exit from the decision they made, they had to stumble over the remains over here, over this area. Such observations can be brought to the forefront and at the stage of the site assessment via this analysis and can aid significantly future interpretive agendas. The image data were also geotagged in GeoSetter, a freeware tool for displaying, arranging and editing geodata and the metadata of image files. Both GPS tracks and image files, along with other geodata, for example the location of the available information panels, were also exported in Google Earth, an environment which further allowed the exploration of aggregated data in layers. Another benefit of displaying and exploring this data in Google Earth is that one can replay visitor walks and the images they choose to capture, and by combining qualitative data to construct narratives about the visitor's choices of movement. A major step towards making better sense of the collected image data was the hotspot analysis carried out again in ArcGIS with the aggregated and integrated points of image locations captured by visitors. The analysis indicated the areas that visitors recorded the most and provided another yet important interpretation of the site. In ArcGIS, I used this model builder to create a simple model containing a number of geoprocessing tools. I won't say more about that. And the analysis generated 72 unique locations of the hotspots, which represent weighted clusters of image data. The results are visualized according to icon field, which means the sum of all incidents, in this case the images captured, at each location. As you can see, the red dots indicate the areas that visitors captured the most, and following the range color from warm to cold, the blue areas indicate fewer recordings. Considering that people take photographs of instances and of the things they want to remember from their visit, this experiment reveals the hotspots of the site as the visitors assess them. In order to identify recurrent patterns and themes in the data, I proceeded with a thematic analysis for each hotspot according to two main questions. From which spots are visitors capturing general views of the site or views of the surroundings? And what attracted their attention the most from the artifacts, the structures and the contemporary features within the site? In the applied thematic analysis, codes are then typically developed to represent the identified themes. The coding system here is designed to allow a cross-site examination of the recurrent themes in each location. As you can see from the example here of the stone basins over here, they appear by 14% in the hotspot 69 and 4.5% throughout the site. Next, I'm going to experiment with Atlas BI, a commercial software for the qualitative analysis, as I believe it has more potential to identify and code themes within the same image. To conclude about my methodology, I hope I have demonstrated that the visitor approach has significant benefits for assessing movement, accessibility, and picking out the things that visitors pay attention to and appreciate during their visit. This approach should not necessarily be in contrast to a positivist approach, and that the two are not incompatible. It is what we do after all with the qualitative and quantitative data, and not the methods themselves that define whether you're engaged in a research that is more interpretive or positivist or a hybrid of the two. Novel technologies and methods provide a set of tools to explore various theories and generate new questions about the data sets and hypotheses, and this is becoming more apparent in our days. I should mention also that the visitor search data collection could be implemented with the use of visitors' personal mobile devices through existing geotagging applications. Although I personally use these applications, most of the visitors did not carry their smartphones if they had one with them. And if they did have, if they were owners of a smartphone, they didn't actually use it because of the excessive roaming rates. The European Commission strategy articulates the message that information and communication technology should be treated as goods accessible and affordable for the Commonwealth societies above and beyond the notion of profit. Also, Europe's digital agenda includes further digitization of the cultural heritage and low roaming tariffs, a fact that will facilitate immensely cross-regional accessibility to heritage content via mobile phones. Provided that these criteria are met, location-based information accessed via personal mobile devices is certainly pointing towards the future of interpretation for heritage sites. The stakeholders have shown a keen interest in the use of ICT to enhance the presentation of the monuments and sites. Before the advent of information and communication technologies, the objectives of the NAME Charter were often difficult to achieve due to the static nature and the space limitations of descriptive panels and uniform visitor itineraries. Visitors ask for more information and personalized experiences, and these demands cannot be fulfilled by imposing restrictions or designing interpretive infrastructure that challenge the aesthetics of the monument and perhaps create more confusion to the spatial perception of these sites. And in terms of future work, in the coming months, I intend to proceed further with the interpretation of my data and conduct further time and space analysis of the GPS data. Also, I need to combine the results of the hotspot and thematic analysis with the qualitative analysis I did, finalize the interpretation. This summer, also, I plan to collect data from Knossos for the assessment of this current walk and conduct a thorough comparative study between the two sites. Finally, the results will be used for the development of an augmented reality mobile application, which will provide location-based information at the hotspots as indicated by the visitors. The novelty here is not is the visitor search approach for the development of the application rather than the technology itself, which is also quite new. And that would be the end. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you very much for a extremely rich presentation. I particularly love the images. I mean, I look forward to going through those again. I'll just be trying a little really weird thing. If you want to shout them, you can do that. Throw rocks at their mind, it's not good.
That would be a question.
extremely rich data set you've extracted out of EMEA, moving on to another. Have you got equally rich data sets from the other side?
I've got the qualitative, the observations that gave me the framework of the issues that these sites face, but I have not done the actual GPS and image data collection. And I'm thinking that it would be worth doing it in Knossos, because there you have the example of the site that has all sorts of interventions, from the restoration of Evans to current conservation work and the implemented walks. And then you have Bunia, which is quite serene and quite free to walk in. So I think these two sites are the ones that need to be compared.
You have to get back on the track today, and you end up with a tremendously large data set that hopefully you can make available to people once you finish.
Yes, already the effort has asked me for this data.
The camp in Bondi is an opposite example of that. That was the first place that I'm aware of, and the Empire Note earlier one, where they created a virtual tour. Because of the damage to the second level protection, I guess, and the damage they created that the bubble you can go into, you can on a virtual tour. Nobody else do that. You can leave the building building from the top, that's kind of your original criteria, so this is my proper question.
Mm-hmm.
Your original criteria for selecting the sites you're going to look at, what criteria did you use for picking them? Availability and accessibility?
Yes.
You like them?
Well, one thing is that I did have the experience and the chance to work there in Eastern Greece for a project for 4 years. So I knew the site, and because when I did my master's in architecture and my house and work local site, I started creating the idea that these sites cannot have restorations. What happened in Knossos is not happening anymore, of course. It's not legitimate. So I was thinking about ways of dealing with these sites that are not like classical, where you can perform proper restoration. So that was the first reason. And then when I started looking at the site and the material, I found that Gounia, because of the reasons I mentioned, is a really excellent case study for observing how people perceive it and walk. And then Knossos has so many interventions on the walking paths, and on the other hand, you see, and I talked with the architects of Knossos, where they were the ones with archaeologists that they implemented they conceptualized and implemented the actual walks. And from my observations, they thought that an analysis of that sort would give them feedback about how well these implemented walks work, actually. Because they conceptualized it and they implemented it, and of course it was based heavily on the first priority of protecting the site from the visitors. That was the first priority. But then what happens in terms of how it has altered the experience of the place? And there's many people that came after the souvenir, as I said, and they said, I love it, but it's free to walk and it's not commercial, and I enjoy it more than something. It's weird to.
Yeah, balance between making the site accessible and protecting the site. So I'm going to be quiet.
Yeah.
And I have a question. What is the profile for people
Mainly tourists. There have been. I've had many Greeks as well, but mainly tourists, and they are mainly from Europe. At least the percentages of my sample.
And in the first stage of the research, which is the more positive and more nice, did you find significant changes of patterns, which is like age, gender, nationality, and the responses, or there was
That's a good question. To be honest, because I have not interpreted fully my data, I cannot really answer to this question at this point, because my first observation wanted to feed the methodology that I tried to create. It varies, I would say. It doesn't really. I had some young. I was not supposed to, of course, interview younger kids, but I could hear them when I spoke to their parents and stuff to comment. A phrase that I remember I can recollect now, stuck in my head, is that I wish you could give us a representation of the site as you think it may have been like. And to phrase this question in such a manner from a 10-year-old kid, and he was actually from the UK. It was
experience.
Yes, it was really, really important to that he could differentiate what he would think it would be like, or what the program will, what we think it looks like.
And just to take the last three questions, I plan to do all things after the jail, the day of the election, the legal day. For example, because it can be very, I'm managing to know the how to be moved, but how are we going to tell the candidates why it's going to work well? Because maybe it's going to be interested, but also going to get tired.
Yes, the reasons. I understand that's a very good point. The reason I try to develop these methodologies is exactly to make a point to say that we can ask some of the visitors not on the spot, because then they lose, they're going to respond differently if you follow them or if you hustle them. Of course, they're going to give you the answer that you want to hear, perhaps, so you're never sure about the data. I developed this methodology to show that you can actually see an overview. You can have some results that indicate some areas that, for some reason, are showing something inside. Either people stop to have a lot of pictures there because it has a great panoramic view of the site, so this is a nice spot to design something, a stop, or so I just wanted to have the aggregated data.
Have you thought or about producing a legitimate way to get invented what people are interested in? Pictures that people posted on Twitter?
Yeah, or maybe you were not here from the beginning, but I did use a lot of web image repositories.
Okay.
And Flickr, Panoramio, all of these sites are really. But the thing is that I could not base my methodology on the geotagging people do, because it's completely irrelevant. If you see, they just put them in anywhere around the site. They are not control. And it makes sense.
Yeah, what's the one you've brought in here? Because I've only been there the winter and the spring, I've never been the summer, so I've been there, I keep the empty. But the summer you get, what's the amount of
digital? I mean, about the amount of digital. Yes. Well, the amount of 36 GPS tracks, I managed to get them with three GPSs, and considering that the site is open from 9 to 3. Also considering that some of them might take 1 hour around, so I had only three GPSs to... I had to stay 4 days at Bunia, only for the GPS data collection. So, yes, they're not many, but...
No.
I'm also curious. You mentioned that you're looking at all the site interpretation to try and fit. With the digital movement, how much were you considering like outside things like guidebooks or travel books? Were you taking that into consideration?
Yes. After they came back and in the questionnaire, I have a question asking them how they visited and all the kind of general information about their visit. Were they with partners or family, or they were alone? And if they carried, how did they know the site in the first place when they came? And then if they used a guide or a map to navigate. So I have this data along the way.
That's one of the things that's going to come up with comparison of the two sites. If you look at public scholarship on museums, you have people who go to the museum because they're interested in what the museum holds, or they're interested in going to the museum. So in London, you have to go to the British Museum. You're in Crete, you have to go to the Gnostics. You can't go home and say you didn't go there. You can go home and say you didn't go to Gnostics. That would be okay, nobody would be shocked. They would be shocked if you didn't go to Gnostics. So you're going to have a difference between, and I'm sure you've planted this in, people who are actually interested in staying on the set, and people who are going with the experience.
Exactly.
Or, like a family outing, you think.
It is. And,
when we used to do this.
It is like that. And there's a book, there's a colleague, it's called Solomon, Esther, and she did a survey in Machoche about how and why they visit Machoche, the visitors, and many of the responses were also due to a book that came out in 2002, Getting Lost in the Labyrinth. Many people read this book and they just wanted to go to Crete and enjoy the sun and everything, and in that to release the link for the Lost in the Labyrinth.
Same for every time, but then.
How do you mix the method in consciousness? What kind of how can you coordinate with them? How are you gonna mingle the two so that you give a bit more depth to the quantitative
aspect? It's down to actually writing down as much as we can, and when one methodology has a purpose to serve one research question and it's not enough, then you go back to your qualitative data and you're trying to look there for answers. So the computing methodologies give you the quantity of or the symptoms that these sites have from the visitors, or how the visitors walk. So as you saw in this particular map, for example.
So you wouldn't use a questionnaire qualitatively.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. There's a lot bigger confusion.
Because that you can see an aggregated movement around, and you can say, as with the example I gave in this area, you can say, oh, why is there so much accessibility and stuff? And then you see the symptom and you see that there's, okay, that's a fact, we have something going on here, and you go back to your qualitative analysis and then you try to feed in. Some people, for example, mentioned, I was really interested, I saw that there is something like a sewage system, but there was no information about it. And then they actually try to make it as a purpose of as a gene in their walk, to find more of these pipes and more of these openings in the walls. And I wouldn't have known just with these, but I can go back and trace their walk.
So the question is, you don't have I
also did in the beginning, I have a bigger sample of qualitative and observations that happened that are not linked to the GPS track, and then the rest of the methodology. So.
Whether this is weak in terms of the actual dimension, because for example, when you use it as a sensitive, we basically use a manual GPS kind of thing, so mm-hmm. we're tracking people and
yes.
marking the routes and getting all the information. I'm going to look at which way mm-hmm. the technology is actually weaker or not. So how long does it take for something
to process
it, yeah.
That's really, it can take a day.
Okay, within a day, so you can do, for example,
The only way in museums, they tried other ways of recording people with other sort of technologies, because the GPS program work indoors. As I said in my talk, it's more you have the data and you can actually present more evidence, and also the planners, because they work with maps, they work with a conceptualization of the intended interventions. It works really well if you get a sense of the site with this sort of method.
That's a great advantage of this method, is that you've got additional data in there, you might not necessarily need. You might think of the use of it later on.
Exactly.
When you're doing, I've had students doing an exam sort of thing, you end up having to follow people around and not get reported from one of the guards or something like that, a stalker. And they're writing down what they're interested in. But if you've got the automated process of downloading and archiving all the data, or providing your archive all the whole lot, then hey, you can always revisit it at a later stage, or somebody else can for their research, it might be totally different from yours. Which is a very question about the stuff in that story.
Thank you.
Welcome.
Thank you. The other thing is that, for example, with the hotspot analysis, I did it having in mind that I'm going to create a mobile application. The augmented, it doesn't matter if it's augmented or, but I'm interested in augmented reality anyways. So with this methodology, I have exactly the points where most of the activities happening, or if the place where it's attracting more of the visitor's attention. So you can easily see there's other matters, for example, in mobile applications, that if you create a web-based application, then you might have a clustering of information all over your mobile, small mobile screen. So that causes many different problems. But if you create beside the hotspots, and then you have the information popping up as the visitor goes by and notified either by a very subtle way, for example, I'm really keen and we are collaborating with human computer interaction researchers where there is an amazing application. It's called I Did It My Way. In the paper that they published, and it's basically a bracelet, a vibrating bracelet, that and the application works like Google Maps, that you set up your destination, but instead of being stuck in the screen, you just put it in your pocket, and when you just wander off, that reminds you that you are very subtly with a vibration. It tells you you're a bit off, but you can ignore it because maybe you get carried away from the architecture of the streets or. And then if you want to go back, there's another functioning that I can answer to the first the opening you made for the questions about what you should do with the people that walk over the road. So that would be an amazing, for example.
You could have to get a mild electric shock.
No, but it can pop up, for example, when they do that, they can pop up information about the conservation state and how the movement affects or deteriorates the walk, stuff like that. It'd be amazing.
Okay, one thing that I thought might have come up down the end there, and your very first pictures of people climbing across the walls, one would assume that they're trying to get to something interesting that they've seen over there and there's a wall in the way. And that was linking up with this picture here, which made me think of something that I was familiar with. One thing that is being researched, or has been researched for a couple of decades, up the road there at UCML at the Bartlett, is the Department of Space Impact, where they have like social economic space and work at the RMB in Hanson, where they're looking at social logical space. But I had a friend whose master's dissertation was on applying those techniques to Mycenaean palaces in Crete. So these are exactly the sorts of things that can be embedded in this as well. The lines of sight, and a very, very simple theory, if I've got it right, is that you walk in a direction and you can sort of see whether there's something there. So if you can see your way out or your way in, that's where you go. You don't go where you can't see whether there's a way out. Mm-hmm. But the problem is, in these, where they're very low, you've got the walls, which is line of sight, that's easy across the building.
Exactly.
So it's one of the, again, the methodologies that we go very, very closely in defining what the climate research is. Have you looked at any of that?
Yes, and that's why I mentioned that there's been a lot of space in that makes urban-based modeling research, especially when, I know that people want to mention the research, but I guess it's only a matter of time that we see with it. That would be an amazing collaborative project, for example. I think it would make a really good collaborative project, but it's, for me, I try to go with real people, real science, real data. And I'm sure in the beginning when I started, I thought I was going to actually use these spacing types and then do the actual and then compare. But in the process, we discussed it. That's a good idea.
Even in fact, it regards engineering because it's the methodology is called in school of.